So the structure will be, firstly, I'll give an introduction to color superconductivity, talk a little bit about phase transitions in quark matter and the gap equation. Then I'll go on to talk about some of the different pairing patterns that are possible. Quark pairing is the essence of color superconductivity, and I'll say a little bit about what different types there are. Because quarks are interesting complex objects with many different properties, color, flavor, and so forth, there are many ways of putting them together. And the favored ones appear to be color flavor locking and something else called 2SC, and I'll tell you what they are. Then I'll move on to the place in the universe which is most likely to be hosting color superconducting quark matter at this very minute, and that is compact stars, which are same as neutron stars, except when you call them a compact star, you're kind of leaving open the option that they don't contain only neutrons, so there's something more interesting in there. And I'll say something about the possible phenomenology there. For example, it's unlikely that the two-flavor phase is sitting there in bulk. The color-flavor-locked phase might be there, and I'll say a little bit about its possible interface between it and the nuclear matter. And there are various reviews out there. There are other ones that I haven't mentioned by, for example, Steve Hsu and Thomas Schaefer, and, you know, everyone here has written a review. Okay, so there are various regimes for QCD. One of them is the regime that we're living in right now, the low temperature, low density regime. Thank you, the halberd. Low temperature, low density regime, that's us now, confinement, broken chiral symmetry, hadrons. Then there's the high temperature regime, the world of the quark gluon plasma, where chiral symmetry is restored, there's deconfinement, and this is what is being sought at heavy ion colliders. And then what I'm going to talk about is the high density regime. This is the regime of color superconductivity, and this is where the quarks pair, BCS pairing, in color non-singlets. And there are various phases. In the three-flavor case, there's color flavor locking, where chiral symmetry is actually broken and baryon number is broken. In the two-flavor case, there's the so-called 2SC phase, where, for the sake of diversity, chiral symmetry is not broken and neither is baryon number. So these are quite different from each other. And a question we might ask is, why is the two-flavor case so different from the three-flavor case? And another question we might ask is, what sort of quark matter do we expect to find out there in the universe, and the main place where we might expect to successfully look for it is in compact stars? Okay, so what happens when you have quarks at very high density? Well, if you have sufficiently high density and sufficiently low temperature, then you'll get a Fermi C, and since QCD is asymptotically free, when the Fermi momentum gets high, you'll be able to think of the quarks near the Fermi surface as being almost free. So you fill up a Fermi C, this is momentum and energy here, you fill it up to some Fermi energy here, and if they were really free, if there was really no QCD, this is all that would happen. You know, you just fill up a sea of Fermi quarks and that's the end of the story. But really, there is QCD, they do have interactions, and those interactions are attractive. This is very important, because we can immediately draw on a result from condensed matter physics. Any attractive interaction between fermions that you fill a Fermi C with causes a pairing instability of the Fermi surface. This is the BCS mechanism of superconductivity. And it leads to an expectation value of the quark-quark operator, so that the vacuum state is not an eigenstate of quark number. If you act on the vacuum with two quarks, you get something that has a non-zero overlap with the vacuum again. So it has indefinite quark number. Now you can see in an intuitive way why this instability is there. If you think about the energetics, when you filled up the Fermi C, your free energy is the energy minus the chemical potential times the number of particles. And You've minimized that. That's how you got the Fermi C in the first place. You minimized the free energy. And what that means is that the marginal cost in free energy of adding or subtracting a quark at the Fermi surface is zero. It costs you a certain amount of energy to put one in, but because you've increased the quark number by one, you get a certain amount of energy out of the particle bath, and those two things compensate for each other. And the same is true if you want to take one out. You're at the minimum. Okay. That's the end of the story, as I said before, if there are no interactions. But if there's an attractive interaction, then you can put in, you can do this twice, put in two quarks, and then it doesn't cost you anything, but their attractive interaction lowers the free energy a little bit. So you found that you can do something that lowers the free energy of the Fermi surface thanks to the existence of an attractive interaction that can be arbitrarily weak. So you do it again, and again, and again, and again. It's an instability. It's a way of lowering the energy of the system, the free energy of the system. So that is the intuitive understanding of the BCS mechanism, that a Fermi surface in the presence of an attractive interaction is not stable. Now, it wasn't so easy to get this to fly in condensed matter physics, where electrons, which are the relevant fermions, tend to repel each other electrostatically. And you have to look for subtle phonon-mediated interactions to find an attraction and arrange things for this pairing to happen. Quarks are not like that. Quarks are nature's born superconducting fermions, if you like. Their lowest order, strong, gauge-mediated interaction is attractive. QCD attracts quarks together, as we know, because it makes them form the baryons that are us. So how do you go looking for this in field theory? Well, you do some Schwinger-Dyson equations. The way you look for spontaneous symmetry breaking, formation of a quark-quark condensate in this case, is you make an ansatz for the self-energy. So you put in a guess. You know, I think that quark pairings are going to happen of such and such a form. And that is a self-energy term. Okay? You can then build a full propagator out of self-energy terms. You know, the quark is going along, it goes through one, it goes through two, it goes through however many. You just add them all up, and this is the definition of the full propagator. So you've expressed the full propagator in terms of the self-energy. You then return the favor, express the self-energy back in terms of the full propagator again. If you have a simple theory with some four-point interaction, or this could be gluon exchange or an instanton or something in QCD, you get a diagram that looks like this, and then you get corrections that look like this. Now, in an NJL model, you just have to do the mean field approximation and discard these. In asymptotically high-density QCD, you can neglect these on the basis that the coupling is small. However you do it, you have ended up expressing the self-energy in terms of the self-energy. So you've derived an equation that can tell you whether the guess you've made corresponds to a stable vacuum. It's the field-theoretic way of doing a variational calculation. You could guess a family of vacua and see if there's a minimum of the free energy in that family. So this gives you an equation. The equation that tells you whether there is such a stable vacuum is the gap equation. And the gap equation involves the notional strength of the quark-quark pairing. And the point is to find out if it happens, and if so, how strongly. So it's the one-particle irreducible two-point function, which is just the self-energy. But it's the funny one. It's not the ordinary self-energy that just has a quark propagating along and says, you know, this, I'm like a mass term, now carry on. This is one that eats up two quarks. So it's, you might call it an anomalous self-energy. To find out if there is such a thing, to find out if this sort of quark pairing really happens, you solve the gap equation. So this is the simplest form of gap equation. It's the kind you get out of a theory with a point-like interaction, an NJL model of QCD. It's gratifyingly simple. The right-hand side looks a lot like a one-loop integral, which is not surprising because you saw on the previous transparency that's just where it came from. And you get 1 equals this right-hand side, and it's got the coupling out front here, which came from the interaction vertex on that one loop. And you've got an integral over the momenta, and you've got an integrand. And the integrand is monotonically decreasing in the amount of quark-quark pairing, which is what we want to find out from solving this equation, this turquoise delta. So we could have a plot here of the strength of the pairing delta and the right-hand side of the gap equation, and it's monotonically decreasing, so as delta gets big, the right-hand side gets small. But, crucially, when delta goes to zero, the right-hand side blows up because there's a singularity associated with momenta near the Fermi surface, P equal to mu. This is for massless quarks. So it would be energies near the Fermi surface, really. So this is exactly reflecting that intuitive mechanism that there was something special about the quarks at the Fermi surface that you could add them or take them out for free. And you see that showing up in this singularity, which causes this right-hand side to blow up at low delta and guarantees that there will always be a solution, no matter how weak the interaction may be. There's always a solution to the gap equation, a non-trivial pairing. Now, you can do this roughly for the case of delta small. You can evaluate the integral, and it's a logarithmic divergence in this delta. So you get one is this. You switch it around, and you find that the gap goes like e to the minus 1 over the interaction strength. This is something that you would never see in perturbation theory. This function has no derivatives around k equals 0. So it's a non-perturbative result. It was crucial that you put in information by putting in that ansatz, putting in that guess in the first place. And then you got out a result that it was a consistent guess. All right, now let's talk about some of the different patterns of pairing that are possible. You discover this by formulating gap equations for each of these patterns and solving them and comparing free energies to see which is the favored one. The most interesting, one that was mentioned by Frank Wilczek on Monday, is the three-flavor pattern. And in the case of three massless flavors, it's particularly clear. It's called color-flavor locking. And in this case, you have an equal number of colors and flavors. And that gives you a special pattern of pairing, where if we write our two quarks here with their color indices, alpha and beta, and flavor indices, I and j, the pattern is this, delta, alpha, I, delta, beta, j, and so forth. What it says is that if we are two quarks, you know, me and my laptop, then either my color is the same as its flavor, and its color is the same as my flavor, or my color is the same as my flavor, and its color is the same as its flavor. That's what these two delta functions here say. It may sound strange to be identifying color with flavor. There's obviously some arbitrariness in this. But then there's always arbitrariness in spontaneous symmetry breaking. A ferromagnet makes an arbitrary choice of which direction to point in. And here, there's an arbitrary choice made of identifying colors with flavors. The interesting thing about this pattern is that by connecting colors and flavors together, it connects the color and flavor symmetries. You find that in the presence of this sort of condensate, if you try to do a color rotation of it from the gauged color group, then that can be compensated by an opposite rotation from the flavor group, the SU3 flavor group, because we have three quark flavors. Equal and opposite rotations cancel out, because this thing, by having a delta function that connects color and flavor indices, enables a color matrix and a flavor matrix to multiply each other. So when you come in with your equal and opposite color and flavor rotations, they multiply each other through these delta functions, and the condensate comes back again exactly the same. Now, if the condensate is only identical under equal and opposite color and flavor rotations, then this forces it to break chiral symmetry, because color is only a vector symmetry. You can't do independent left-handed and right-handed color rotations, because it's a gauge symmetry, and there is only one gauge field. So only vector color is a symmetry of QCD, which means that only vector flavor symmetries combined with equal and opposite color symmetries, symmetry rotations can survive. So what survives is the diagonal SU3 that's combined color and left flavor and right flavor rotations and a Z2 left over from the baryon number. But the axial part of the flavor rotations is broken. So this thing breaks chiral symmetry, but not by a Q-bar-Q condensate, but by a quark-quark condensate. And as Frank mentioned, this means that there doesn't have to be a phase transition in the three massless flavor case between the low-density and high-density phases. Also, interestingly, there is a new electromagnetism in town. The original electromagnetism lived in the flavor group. It was a gauged U1 living in there. There is still an unbroken gauged U1 around. It's just living inside this new unbroken flavor group. And since this consists of combined color and flavor rotations, what that means to the ordinary occupant of a phase like this is that the new photon that propagates around the place is actually a mixture of the original photon and one of the gluons. So all the charges of particles under this new photon are different from what they were under the old one. This is not quite as exotic as it sounds, because of course it's exactly where the old photon came from. The old photon underwent the same birth process up at the electroweak scale, where it emerged as a linear combination of the W3 and hypercharged bosons, the linear combination that left the Higgs invariant. And here, the same thing has been repeated over again, and there's been a mixing of glue and electromagnetism to produce something that leaves this quark condensate invariant. So here's a phase diagram for the three massless flavor case. So it's not completely realistic. I'll show you something a bit more realistic later on. It's the usual thing with quark chemical potential along here and temperature up there. And in the case of three massless flavors, we expect a first-order chiral symmetry restoring phase transition as you increase the temperature without introducing any chemical potential. And the important thing about the color superconducting phase is that it means that this line doesn't go down to the t equals zero axis here, but levels out and actually eventually goes back up again. So that at high density, chiral symmetry remains broken, but by a CFL quark-quark condensate. You can also find a baryon number violating breaking line in here, where baryon number is spontaneously broken. If you increase the chemical potential at zero temperature, then you're in the vacuum at first, and then at some point you make hypernuclear matter. The octet of baryons all have the same mass, so you make them all together, you make hypernuclear matter, and then there needn't be a phase transition between that and color superconducting quark matter. All right. This is what quark hadron continuity looks like in the fermion sector. In those two regions between which there needn't have been a phase transition, in the lower density region, there's a bunch of hyperons, proton, neutron, the xis, and the sigmas, and the lambda. And you can sort them according to how they would transform under isospin, which would be more relevant if they weren't all the same mass. But it's still, still a symmetry, and under their electric charge. You can then go up into the CFL region and see what are the corresponding excitations up there, and they are quark excitations. The blue up and down quarks form a doublet under the new isospin, which is a mixture of the old one and color rotations, and the Q twiddle, the new electric charge of these, is plus one and zero, just like the proton and neutron. Similarly, the red and green stranges form an iso doublet with appropriate charges to look like the cascades, and these three guys form an iso triplet that looks like the sigmas, this guy looks like the lambda, and of course, since there are 9 quarks, 3 colors times 3 flavors, there's one left over. This guy, it turns out, has twice as big a gap as the others, and so it's reasonable to not try and map it onto the baryon octet and to say it's a heavier thing that may correspond to some heavier baryon resonance. So this is what quark hadron continuity looks like when you try and make a mapping between those two regions that needn't have a phase transition between them. Okay, let me talk briefly about the two-flavor guy. So now what would happen if the strange quark were too heavy to be involved in pairing with its up and down colleagues? In this case, you have a structure where, because you've only got two flavors, you can easily make a flavor singlet, up, down, minus, down, up, but your two color indices can't make a color singlet. They just have to choose some color direction in which to point. They have to be red and green or something like that. So this thing is forced to break the color gauge symmetry down to a smaller group, but it doesn't break any of the flavor symmetries. It doesn't break the global symmetries. You do get the same trick repeating itself, though, with the with electromagnetism. There's a new electromagnetism in town, which is a mixture of one of the broken gluons and the original photon. There are no global symmetries broken, so there isn't an order parameter that distinguishes this from the quark-gluon plasma, although it's quite clearly distinguished from nuclear matter because chiral symmetry is restored here. And I haven't mentioned baryon number because baryon number is actually just a combination of isospin and electric charge if you only have two flavors around. And so there is a new unbroken baryon number, which is a mixture of the old one and a color rotation. Okay. Now, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, so don't get worried about this maze. I just want to say that, so I talked about the zero strange quark mass color flavor locked and the high strange quark mass two flavor case. In between the two, if the strange quark mass is low enough, you get into a situation where, yes, the up strange and down strange pairs are not quite the same as the up down pairs, but it's basically a lot like color flavor locking. There's a, you just lock an SU2, the SU2 flavor for the ups and downs is locked to an SU2 subgroup of the color group, but you get a very similar color flavor locking pattern when you turn on a small enough strange quark mass. And there may be other interesting things that happen, like kaon condensation, but I'm not going to say anything about that. Thomas might say something about that later. All right, let's go on to a little bit of the real world, admittedly slightly far away. Compact stars. So where is the home of the color superconducting quark matter? Well, the place where it's most comfortable is in somewhere that's very dense and nice and cold, because you don't want too many thermal excitations that are going to break up that nice ordered pairing. It is, by the way, the highest temperature superconductor in the universe. It's not, doesn't need, you know, 10 Kelvin or anything. It's happy up to MeV scales and beyond, probably. Sorry? Right, yes, okay. Relative to the chemical potential, it's high too, right? Yes, so a compact star, as I guess most of us know, starts off as a sufficiently heavy star that does the usual burning of hydrogen to produce energy and ends up with an iron core, which if it becomes heavy enough, collapses, creates a supernova, and leaves behind this remnant, which is a compact star. And compact stars have masses in the range of 1.5 or so solar masses, radii that we think are of the order of 10 kilometers, densities that are nuclear density growing as you go into the middle, and they start off reasonably hot and then cool for the first million years or so, mainly by emitting neutrinos. Now, the great thing would be if you could find some signature in the behavior of a compact star that would diagnose the presence of color superconducting quark matter inside it. And this is a difficult thing because they're far away and you want what's inside them, but people are working on this. One of the places where you expect to see an influence of quark pairing, color superconductivity, is in the transport properties, because the transport properties are all to do with the little fluctuations around the ground state, fluctuations around the Fermi surface, and your quark pairing has put a gap at the Fermi surface. It's gapped the excitations at the Fermi surface, and so you expect it to have a profound impact on transport properties, things like mean free paths, viscosities, conductivities, and those kind of things. One of the possible pieces of phenomenology relates to the crystalline pairing phase, which, if you can have some sort of crystalline quark matter, gives you a rigid structure, breaking and rearrangement of which could be associated with funny discontinuous behavior, such as glitches, which are observed in neutron stars. Another possibility is that it would influence the neutrino emission. For example, the cooling that occurs over the life of the neutron star, and the pulse that's emitted when it's born. Another possibility is related to viscosity. It's the R-mode instability. It's an instability whereby if the viscosity isn't too high, the neutron star is able to radiate off gravitational radiation very efficiently and get rid of a whole bunch of angular momentum that way. So there's various things in the transport properties that might indicate the presence of color superconducting quark matter inside a compact star. The equation of state also might be a hint, because although the influence of the pairing is like this in the pressure, it's delta squared mu squared, which is much smaller than the basic pressure of quark matter, you've got to remember that there's a Bragg constant there, which, if it's large enough to bring quark matter close to stability, anywhere close to stability, then it's, that's another way of saying it's canceling out a large part of this, and a superconducting gap may have a large effect on just how stable it is. What sort of constraints do we have to impose on quark matter in compact stars? So what kind of pairing are we going to expect to see there at the end of the day? Well, you have to impose weak equilibrium because there's plenty of time for weak processes to happen. The neutrinos escape from the star, so you find that your up, down, and strange chemical potentials can be expressed in terms of a basic baryon number or quark number chemical potential and a sort of negative electric charge chemical potential, which is just the negative electrostatic potential. And you've got to impose neutrality, both color neutrality and electromagnetic neutrality. Electromagnetic neutrality just says the charges add up to zero. Color neutrality says that in unitary gauge, you want to make the number of quarks of different colors the same so that you'll be able to then project to a color singlet if you want to, and it won't cost you anything. Now, this immediately raises the question of whether the two-flavor phase occurs in compact stars, because the CFL phase, the three-flavor phase, is innately neutral, and imposing these sort of constraints on it doesn't have much effect. But the two-flavor phase is not naturally neutral, and when you impose the requirement that it be neutral, you find you need an electrostatic potential, and this imposes a free energy cost. And you can do an expansion in powers of the strange quark mass divided by the chemical potential and the pairing gap divided by the chemical potential, and you find that actually this is rather bad news for bulk matter of this two-flavor, 2SC quark-paired variety. Here's a figure of the gap and the energy relative to unpaired matter, the free energy relative to unpaired matter. So unpaired quark matter is this horizontal black line. And the color flavor locked phase is this red line, and the 2SC phase is this dashed blue line, and obviously the lowest free energy always wins. And so what you can see is that if you assume that the gap is the same, and the strange quark mass and everything are the same between the two phases, then at low gaps, the unpaired quark matter wins, and then it switches to color flavor locked, and the two-flavor guy never really gets a look in. If you try and be a tiny bit more realistic and take into account some of the differences between the two phases, like that the gap is, in fact, a bit larger in the color-flavor locked phase and the strange quark mass is a bit smaller, then it makes things even worse for the two-flavor guy. You find that it goes straight from unpaired to color-flavor locked, and you never get a chance to make the two-flavor superconductor. So if you wanted to have bulk matter, then it's hard to have it be the two-flavor type. It could still occur in mixed phases, for example, and it could still occur in situations where you don't have to equilibrate in these ways, such as in a heavy ion collision, if it were cool enough to make something like this. This unpaired region, it's interesting to ask, it looks unpaired in a, we don't know where nuclear matter is, so we don't know exactly what happens, but there may well be an unpaired region here. And of course, you can't really have an unpaired region. The quarks will find something to do. They'll find some pairing type instability, and that could be crystalline pairing or self-pairing of each flavor with itself. So let me give you a slightly more realistic possible phase diagram for bulk nuclear slash quark matter. So chemical potential and temperature, and you would have nuclear matter down here. So you go from the vacuum into nuclear matter. This is the usual critical line and first order line and critical point associated with the restoration of the approximate chiral symmetry. It's only approximate in the real world. Out here is the color flavor locked phase, and in here, if there is a window like this between nuclear matter and color flavor locked matter, there'll be this window where the obvious guess, 2SC, can't happen, and a very natural thing to happen here would be the crystalline quark matter. And if you want to learn more about that, you can go and look at Jeff Bauer's poster out in the hallway. Okay, well, my time is running out, so I won't say that much more. You can ask also what might happen if there were not any intervening phase between the nuclear matter and the color flavor locked matter. You just went straight from nuclear to CFL quark matter. And then there are some very interesting things that might happen. You can ask if there's a mixed phase. You can go from the nuclear matter, which is neutral along this line, to the quark matter, which is neutral along this line, in two ways. You can jump from one to the other at a sharp transition, or you can move along the coexistence line of one being positively charged and the other being negatively charged and have mixed phases with charge separation in them. And this has been looked at a little bit to see how likely it is that you'd get this sort of mixed phase, and the great uncertainty there is the surface tension. Obviously, if the surface tension is very small, it doesn't cost anything to make a mixed phase, and certainly you'll do that. If the surface tension is large enough, it's too expensive to make a mixed phase that mixes the plus and minus phases together intimately enough for their electric fields to not be too big. And so we just parameterized this. This was done with Krishna and Sanjay Reddy and Frank. Parameterized the surface tension, well, just some number, sigma, and we look to see what would happen. And when this thing is, as a function of chemical potential along here, when it's negative, the mixed phase is favored. And so when the chemical, surface tension was zero, obviously it made a mixed phase the whole way through. We found you only had to turn the surface tension up to 40 MeV per square Fermi, and suddenly all the mixed phase bits up here were above zero, meaning that it preferred to do a sharp interface. So there is a real possibility there might be a sharp interface. I hit the 0 minutes. Okay, stop talking. Yes, I like that. I'm almost there, you see. if you have a sharp interface like that, it could have some phenomenology of its own. If the density changes discontinuously, this could affect the mass-radius relationship, and it could also affect the gravitational waves emitted when compact stars collide with each other. And this is not completely crazy, because people are building detectors, gravitational wave detectors, precisely to look for collisions between compact stars. So anyway, if it's crazy, then they're crazy. The mixed phase may also have phenomenology, because you'll have this droplet structure which could affect the mean free path of neutrinos, and thereby the time signature of the neutrino pulse. Okay, and jumping to the end. So, looking forward, there's all sorts of interesting ways to push these things forward. There's a good lot of compact star phenomenology. There's the crystalline phase and glitches. There's a little bit of the stuff I mentioned. Implications for neutrino cooling, the R mode that I also mentioned. There's other phenomenology. Our good chairman, Christoph Vetterick and Jürgen Berges, have looked at the possibility of using diquark condensates in the zero density phase to make it sort of look confining, model it as a sort of Higgs phase. And also, it's interesting to think about whether in a heavy ion collision, not a Rick heavy ion collision, I have to be honest, because that's hot with a small net baryon chemical potential, but maybe cooler heavy ion collisions of the kind that might be produced someday in Darmstadt or in Japan, could quark pairing play any kind of role in those? And then there are other questions, possible kaon condensation in the CFL phase, and improvements of our calculations, better weak coupling calculations, including vertex corrections, going beyond mean field. And some of these, I'm sure, will be covered by later speakers today. OK.
Cool. Thank you, Mark.
I wondered if you could comment on the possibility that the star might be completely made of quark matter. In other words, the CFL, for example, all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is that we're actually doing an experiment to look for strangeness in space thrown off by collisions of compact stars, which presumably would be there in large numbers if this were indeed the case. I'm curious what you thought about that.
Okay, well, the R mode calculations currently indicate that is not going to happen. That such a star, if it's CFL strange matter all the way from middle to surface, then it is too good at having R modes. Its viscosity is not high enough, and it will spin down out of the region where we actually see compact stars. So that's not looking so easy to sustain at the moment. Krishna probably wants to make one. Okay.
Yeah, I just want to get a feeling all of the action in this game depends on having a reasonably large gap. I mean, you need...
Well, relative to something, yes. Relative, for example, to the temperature. You don't want to be too hot.
Right, but I mean, how did this is only really phenomenology, how we get a number on the gap. I mean, what are the allowed ranges?
Well, it's difficult to do calculations, obviously, because you're in this strongly coupled regime, and your usual strongly coupled friend, the lattice, is not able to help you. Nambujo and Lacinio models calibrated to give the right chiral symmetry breaking properties predict fairly decent gaps, 100 MeV or so. asymptotic calculations of the type I think Thomas will talk about in a minute can be extrapolated down shamelessly to the regime of interest and give similar values. So at the moment there's you know, the reasonable range seems to be from tens of MeV up to hundreds of MeV.
I mean, if it's 100 or more, then of course one would indeed have a chance to see it in collisions.
That's right.
If it's 10 MeV,
then
you would just completely forget it.
I agree. And so that is why the question might actually in the end be answered in a heavy ion collider and not by theoretical calculation.
So first of all, I'm going to shamelessly advertise Jeff Bowers' poster. The thing you'll notice from Mark's phase diagram is that the crystalline phase had a critical temperature that's comparable to that of the CFL phase.
Yes, that was intentional.
That's a new result, and it's a result which is explained and justified in Jeff's poster. The other thing you'll find in Jeff's poster is the first description of what the actual crystal structure is, which turns out to be FCC. And as far as we know, this is actually a contribution to condensed matter physics also. I don't think the condensed matter physicists have gone as far as we did in answering that question. The other thing I wanted to say to Jack is there is a press conference happening today at which some astrophysicists are announcing the discovery of a strange quark star. And it's not here. It has nothing to do with this meeting. And the local astrophysicist, is Lars in the room? Okay. Lars Bilston is the local expert at the ITP, is extremely skeptical. But let me just say what the claim is. The claim is that some X-ray astronomers have measured the radius of a compact star and found it to be of order 4 to 5 kilometers. And I will say as a theorist that if that were true, then it's extremely exciting and can only be a strange quark star. But one of the things that makes it unlikely to be true is that actually it's even hard for it to be a strange quark star. 4 kilometer strange star has a mass less than a tenth of a solar mass. So it's a giant strangelet. But the point is that this 4 kilometer number is subject to huge caveats, which Lars Bilston, who is, I guess, just upstairs, can explain in detail. And we theorists should wait for this astrophysical result to be suitably scrutinized.
I think I was next in the row. I have a question to this realistic phase diagram that we have seen so often, where you have this phase transition line between a nucleon gas and nuclear matter ending somewhere.
Yeah.
I thought many nuclear physicists believe that nuclear matter is actually a superfluid because of neutron, dineutron condensation, so baryon number would be broken.
Yes.
And
yes, okay.
that means this line can never end.
That's a different line. I should have put in an additional line that corresponds to the melting of the baryon pairing in nuclear matter that would go sort of horizontally. The line I did was sort of the onset line for the appearance of nuclear matter as you turn up the chemical potential, which then continues out into the temperature plane and then disappears at a critical point. But you're correct that there could and should have been an extra line associated with baryon.
If it's a superfluid, there has to be.
There. It was just buried in the axis.
Okay, I think next there was...
Yeah, I wanted to say two things. One is that there was another competitor of another crystalline phase which we worked on, because not only superconducting pair QQ can be a crystal, but the old Q bar Q, which is a sigma in some sense, can also be a crystal, and that is a competitor. The other thing I want to say is that I don't know about this new object, etc., but there was the closest neutron star.
It's the same object.
It's the same object. Oh, then I know that they.
New data on the same object. There's lots of new data on the same object.
Yeah, so that is the closest one from which you can measure by parallax the distance, and that is why they're also saying it was 4 or 5. But people, at least in Stony Brook, said that they found a mistake in. Some technical mistake in the Hubble, etc. So it is not 4 kilometers.
Well,
that the mistake in the parallax is taken into account, but there's new X-ray data. So there's, anyway, this should be done offline, but there's lots of new data. It's the same object, lots of new data, and but that mistake is taken into account, but there are other ones.
I'm sorry. Go, please give him the microphone.
The superconducting gap, as you pointed out, makes the equation of state stiffer. And in a sense, that would, in principle, have the potential for changing the mass-radius relationship for the neutron star.
Indeed.
Or pulsar. Is there any calculation putting this equation of state in the TOV equations to find out
it
what is...
It is in process right now.
Ah, good.
Thank you, and we resume at